So wonderful to sing and chant together. I'd like to read to you something I've written recently to all friends being sent out today. My dear friends, it is with a full heart that I write to you today. An almighty love flows out from my heart to you, a love that is not mine in any sense of the word. It comes from a higher source. Yet, even though I know this love is not mine, I keenly feel it as it flows through this heart out to you. The flowing is coming from a source that is like a limitless sea, moving through the heart as a river, then flowing out into vast creation. This love sings happily as it flows, made sweeter for the movement. Yet there is neither gain nor loss in this movement of love. Rather, it is a movement for sheer joy. The infinite continues to unfold life here according to his perfect plan. Carla had asked that, if possible, we travel less this year. Ram responded by approximately doubling the mileage of travel in the first half of the year. For these summer months, there is less travel, although this next week we are driving to Courtney on Vancouver Island and then to Hornby Island. The garden here was definitely taking a shape of its own with so much travel, a wildness that needed taming. Ram answered my prayers when he sent Bruce and Janice here to help bring rampant growth into some order. We did remove a tree at our neighbor's request that has opened up a vista to the north that looks out over layered mountains. It is very nice. Janice had drawn up plans for a landscape after we moved in, and we are gradually bringing those plans on paper to a living reality. The work here continues on smoothly. We are working on updating the look and content of the Cross and Lotus website. You will not see anything new as of today in this regard. Rather, we will launch a whole new look in the near future. Carla will send out a notice when the time has come. We are also working on getting more of Mother's talks transcribed, a necessary step before we can publish any books based on her talks. This is a long-held, cherished plan I have had. When complete, we will have several books from Mother's teachings on the inner meaning of the scriptures, her poems, prayers, and songs, etc. We are also working on to keep Master's original writings available. These are some of the projects we are working on. The inner work continues with great ferocity. The all-compassionate Lord has continued to use this form to work out many things. This inner work is what takes up the greater part of my days. It is the outer activity. If the outer activities were of a higher priority to him, then he would make me much more efficient in terms of outer projects. The material mind measures things by what is visible. The inner self measures by those things that are less visible. But more than equally real when known through experience. The divine mind continues to guide me through his will, showing me at each step what I should do. The inner guidance makes for a fascinating life. To those who have entered upon this inner life, a tremendous step is taken into a larger world of experience and truth than what could have been imagined before. There's a price to be paid for knowing this still, small voice, referred to by David in the Psalms. First, we have to remove all the blocks in the wall that we have built between ourselves and the sacred presence within. When the blocks are gone, there is nothing more natural than to know this presence as our nearest and dearest one. I want to thank you for your support of this work. Through your deepened meditation practice, through your service to your family and to the world, your extended family, and through your generous material and financial contributions. Without you, this work could not fulfill its mission. This mission was ordained by the Masters in order to fulfill God's will. This world is in such need of healing, with conflicts and fights, with ill-considered actions by individuals, activities they are ignorant of or in blatant abuse of Dharma, the right action based on realized truth. There are so many who feel that what they do does not really matter, so they do what they want without regard to the consequences. Not until each one realizes that every soul has a responsibility to live according to the highest light that he or she knows, will this world realize its true potential? Every action, every word, and every thought carries power to create. When even a small but determined percentage of people live according to this inner truth, the world will change for the better. Others will also be inspired to live according to their highest light. Can you imagine a world where the golden rule, do to others as you would have them do to you, is prevalent amongst families, communities, governments, and between countries? The day is coming when this will be a reality. However, today we are witness to such anger, selfishness, ignorance, and greed that we can despair that the chaos derived from opening this Pandora's box will ever be put right again. However, you should always remember our most basic instinct, even beyond the instinct for survival, is the instinct for the universal vision. This is why, no matter the seeming invincibility of darkness at a particular time, the light is never extinguished. My brothers and sisters of the light, let your light shine. Let it shine within. Let it shine as a light for others stumbling in the dark. Meditate deeply until you are illumined with this light of lights. Let joyful love manifest as service, seva, to the one through simple acts of kindness. You are a conduit of all that is good, lovely, and perfect in the divine, and you are in truth merged in that infinite presence now and always. Share this love with your family, a stranger on the street, and a prayer for this world to always shine with this loving light. Ever in the divine life, David. And a quote from Papa: purity is of the mind, the heart, and the body. The mind sublimates into eternal stillness. The heart expands into infinite space in waves of love and kindness. The body becomes a radiant instrument for the divine power to play its lila in this universal change and movement. Papa used to order and receive the Reader's Digest, and I've been receiving it for some time, and one of the reasons Papa liked it is one of the few magazines that would have articles about God and about things that are positive and uplifting. This is an article by Arthur C. Brooks. He is a PhD, is a professor of business and government policy at Syracuse University Maxwell School of Citizenship and Public Affairs, and a visiting scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. And it's entitled, Why We're Happy. Turns out, happiness has a lot to do with values and its keys to our prosperity as a nation. You want to be happy. I'm going to make this assumption, and I think I'm in pretty smart company to do so. Socrates once asked his students, do not all men desire happiness? A student answered him, there is no one who does not. If Socrates was right, isn't it reasonable to assume that a decent nation will, at minimum, create the conditions in which its citizens can best pursue happiness? In the Declaration of Independence, the founders didn't treat happiness as some fuzzy concept. They believed that people wanted happiness and had the right to pursue it. Along with life and liberty, happiness was the connection between the Creator and our nation's destiny, and the ability of its citizens to pursue and achieve happiness was a measure of the effectiveness and morality of the state. But today's leaders and policymakers seem to have forgotten this. To hear politicians talk about gross domestic product, health care reform, and Social Security, you'd think that this nation's founding fathers held as self-evident that we are endowed by our Creator with the ability to purchase new, high-quality consumer durables each and every year, or to enjoy healthy economic growth with low inflation and full employment. The founders didn't talk about these matters, not because they're unimportant, but because they believed happiness went deeper. As a professor of business and government policy, I've long been interested in the pursuit of happiness as a national concept. According to hundreds of reliable surveys of thousands of people across the land, happy people increase our prosperity and strengthen our communities. They make better citizens, and better citizens are vital to making our nation healthy and strong. Happiness, in other words, is important for America. So when I chanced upon data a couple years ago, saying that certain Americans were living in a manner that facilitated happiness, while others were not, I jumped on it. I wanted to be able to articulate which personal lifestyles and public policies would make us the happiest nation possible. I also wanted to know which of my own values, learned during my childhood in Seattle and practiced during my career as a university professor, were the most conducive to happiness. I had always thought that my marching to the beat of my own drummer and making up my own values as I went along were the right things to do, and that traditional values, to put it bluntly, were for suckers. Turns out that I was in for some surprises. First, just what is happiness? Most researchers agree that it involves an assessment of the good and bad in our lives. It is the emotional balance sheet we keep that allows us to say honestly whether we are living a happy life in spite of bad things now and then. You might suspect that Americans are getting happier all the time. After all, many, though not clearly not all, are getting richer, and this should make them better able and equipped to follow their dreams. On the other hand, there's a lot of talk about good old days when kids could play outside without any worry and about being kidnapped. And there's a great deal of stress in our country right now due to financial concerns, negative workplace environments, and chronic health problems, among other pressing issues. But average happiness levels in America have stayed largely constant for many years. In 1972, 30% of the population said they were very happy with their lives, according to the National Opinion Research Center's General Social Survey. In 1982, 31% said so, and in 2006, 31% said so as well. The percentage saying they were not too happy was similarly constant, generally hovering around 13%. The factors that add up to a happy life for most people are not what we typically hear about. Things like winning the lottery, getting liposuction, and earning a master's degree don't make people happy over the long haul. Rather, the key to happiness and the difference between happy and unhappy Americans is a life that reflects values and practices like faith, hard work, marriage, charity, and freedom. Happiness predictor 1, faith. Roughly 85% of Americans identify with a religion, and about a third of Americans attend a house of worship every week or more. These statistics have changed relatively little over the decades, but international standards, America's level of religious practice is exceptionally high. In Holland, for example, just 9% of the population attends church on a regular basis. In France, it's 7%, and in Latvia, 3%. In general, religious Americans, those who attend a place of worship almost every week or more, are happier than those who rarely or never attend. In 2004, the General Social Survey found that 43% of religious folks said they were very happy with their lives, compared with 23% of secularists. Religious people were a third more likely than secularists to say they're optimistic about the future, and secularists were nearly twice as likely as religious people to say, "I'm inclined to feel I'm a failure." The connection between faith and happiness holds regardless of one's religion. All nonpartisan surveys on the subject have found that Christians, that is Protestants, Catholics, Mormons, and others, and Jews, as well as members of many other traditional sects, are far more likely than secularists to say that they're happy. It also doesn't matter if we measure religious practice in ways other than attendance at worship services. In 2004, 36% of the people who prayed every day said they were very happy, versus 21% of the people who never prayed. Of course, not every religious person is happy, neither is every secularist unhappy. Nonetheless, it's clear that faith is a common value amongst happy Americans. Happiness predictor number two, work. If you hit the lottery today, would you quit your job? If you're like most Americans, you probably wouldn't. When more than 1,000 people across the country were asked in 2002, if you were to get enough money to live comfortably for the rest of your life, would you stop working? Fewer than a third of the respondents answered yes. Contrary to widely held opinion, most Americans like or even love their work. In 2002, an amazing 89% of workers said they were very satisfied or somewhat satisfied with their jobs. This isn't just true for those with high-paying, high-skilled jobs, but for all workers across the board. And the percentage is almost exactly the same amongst those with or without college degrees, and among those working for private companies, nonprofit organizations, and the government. Isn't that surprising? 89%. For most Americans, job satisfaction is nearly equivalent to life satisfaction. Among those people who say they are very happy in their lives, 95% also satisfied with jobs. Furthermore, job satisfaction would seem to be causing overall happiness, not the other way around. The bottom line here, if we want to be happy, we need to work. And that's advice worth sharing with our kids as well. Happiness predictor number three, marriage and family. Matrimony has taken a lot of hits since the 1960s. It has been said to hold many people, especially women, back from their full potential to be happy. Don't believe it. In 2004, 42% of married Americans said they were very happy. Just 23% of never married people said this. The happiness numbers were even lower for other groups. Only 20% of those who are widowed, 17% of those who are divorced, and 11% of those who are separated but not divorced said they were happy. Overall, married people were 6 times more likely to say that they were very happy than to report that they were not too happy. And generally speaking, married women say they're happy more often than married men. Marriage isn't just associated with happiness. It brings happiness, at least for a lot of us. One 2003 study that followed 24,000 people for more than a decade documented a significant increase in happiness after people married. For some, the happiness increase wore off in a few years, and they ended up back at their pre-marriage happiness levels. But for others, it lasted as long as a lifetime. And what about having kids? While children on their own don't appear to raise the happiness level, they actually tend to slightly lower the happiness level of a marriage, studies suggest that children are almost always part of an overall lifestyle of happiness, which is likely to include such things as marriage and religion. Consider this, while 50% of married people of faith who have children consider themselves to be very happy, only 17% of non-religious, unmarried people without kids feel the same way. Happiness predictor number four. Any surprises in all of this so far? Charity. We've all heard that money doesn't buy happiness, and that's certainly true. But there is one way to get it. Give money away. The evidence is clear that gifts to charitable organizations and other worthy causes bring substantial life satisfaction to the givers. If you want $50 in authentic happiness today, just donate it to a favorite charity. people who give money to charity are 43% more likely than non-givers to say that they're very happy. Volunteers are 42% more likely to be very happy than non-volunteers. It doesn't matter whether the gifts of money go to churches or symphony orchestras. Religious giving and secular giving leave people equally happy, and far happier than people who don't give. Even donating blood, and especially personal kind of giving, improves our attitude. In essence, the more people give, the happier they get. Happiness predictor number 5, freedom. The founders listed liberty right up there with the pursuit of happiness as an objective that merited a struggle for our national independence. In fact, freedom and happiness are intimately related. People who consider themselves free are a lot happier than those who don't. In 2000, the General Social Survey revealed that people who personally feel completely free or very free were twice as likely as those who don't say that they're very happy about their lives. Not all types of freedom are the same in terms of happiness, however. Researchers have shown that economic freedom brings happiness, as does political and religious freedom. On the other hand, and this is something to take special note of, on the other hand, moral freedom, a lack of constraints on behavior, does not. People who feel they have unlimited moral choices in their lives when it comes to matters of sex or drugs, for example, tend to be unhappier than those who do not feel they have so many choices in life. Americans appear to understand this quite well. When pollsters asked voters in the 2004 presidential election what the most important issue facing America was, the issue voters chose above all others was moral values. This beat out the economy, terrorism, the Iraq war, education, and health care as people's primary concern. Pundits and politicians would certainly like us to think otherwise, and critics scoffed at the conclusions, interpreting it as evidence that ordinary citizens were out of touch. You'd have to ask, though, there, who's really out of touch when the majority of people are feeling that way. But moral values are critical to Americans. This suggests that, as a people, we are doing best by protecting our political and economic freedoms and guarding against a culture that sanctions licentiousness. Papa used to say that real freedom comes from service, not from license of behavior. Lessons for America. The data tells us that what matters most for happiness is not having a lot of things, but having healthy values. Without these values, our jobs and our economy will bring us soulless toil and joyless riches. Our education will teach us nothing. There will be no reason to fight, or to make peace for that matter, to protect our way of life. Our health care system will keep us healthier, but what's the point of good health without a happy life to enjoy? The facts can help remind us of what we should be paying attention to as individuals and as families if we want to be happy. There's also an important message here for public policy and politics. We must hold our leaders accountable for the facts on happiness and refuse to take it lightly when politicians abridge the values of faith, work, family, charity, and freedom. Candidates running for office should get grilled about happiness in debates and by the press, and their answers should determine our votes. Our happiness is simply too important to us and to America to do anything less. An acute little quote down here at the bottom. I was looking through my closet for something to wear, but nothing was calling out to me. So I sought my three-year-old's opinion. What do you think I should change into? I asked. He thought for a while before replying, a butterfly. I think that's a very interesting article that supports what many of us know intuitively. It's just not always common to find common sense amongst academics. And he himself said that he was surprised at the results and that there would be other academics who would find fault with them. But I think what he says is absolutely true. From Master's commentary on the Bhagavad Gita, this comes from chapter 18, verses 36 through 37. O Arjuna, pray hear from me now about the three kinds of happiness: transcendent happiness or supreme bliss, gained by repeated recollection of the mind, and in which one knows the extinguishment of all pain; that which is born of the clear perceptive discrimination of self-realization. That happiness is called sattvic. It seems like poison at first, but like nectar afterward. It's interesting, isn't it? It seems like poison at first, but like nectar afterward. Master's commentary. When a yogi constantly strives to practice meditative calmness, he ultimately experiences the birth of divine bliss and the end of all sorrow. Suffering is threefold: physical, mental, and spiritual. Physical suffering arises from disease and discomfort. Mental suffering springs in large measure from the sprouted karmic seeds of past evil actions lodged in the astral brain. Spiritual suffering comes from inability to contact God. These threefold sufferings disappear when, by yoga practice, the mind becomes disengaged from the grief-making senses and united to the blessedness of the soul, the true self. Verse 37, however, acknowledges that the initial difficult states of struggle and discontent, unpleasant like poison, experienced by the yogi during his skirmishes with the senses. But after the mind and discriminative intelligence have won the victory, they plant their banner of triumph on the blessed tract of the soul. When the victorious yogi, after his experiences of spiritual struggle, tastes through his interiorized intuitive discrimination the divine amrita, the nectar of the soul, that true happiness is called sattvic. Pure sattvic joy is unending, ever new, culminating at last in the eternal ananda, bliss of spirit, beyond the touch of any guna, even sattva. So here Master is laying out, from a yogi's standpoint, what true happiness really is. In the article before, we heard much about what creates happiness from worldly standards and what people are identifying. And that faith is certainly a part of that. But if we really go further into the science of happiness, we could acknowledge with Socrates' student that all individuals desire happiness. Now, this may fly in the face of how some people behave. But if we were to really analyze each person's behavior, we would see that even when it seems contradictory to finding real happiness, nevertheless, it is that individual's best attempt at finding happiness. Even those people who induce themselves into painful conditions are looking for some happiness through that painful condition. The mind can become so twisted in this material sojourn, our view gets so distorted, that we begin to see that right is wrong, that black is white, and we reverse everything in our mind. Now, this total confusion leads to many destructive, self-destructive, and destruction of the people around us kinds of actions. And therefore, we gain more and more pain through those actions. Now, it seems like some people get away with things. They're perhaps of a criminal state of mind. Perhaps they're cruel. Perhaps they met out punishment that's extraordinary to small children or to other people who are weaker around them. They're bullies. And some people are physical bullies, and some people are emotional bullies. And a bully is someone who learns to get their way by trying to dominate others, by trying to induce a state of fear in others and to become dominant themselves. And this is one of the most evil kinds of activities that we can engage in as human beings. We see it all over the place. We see it with parents who give out too much in the way of punishment. They go after their children, they beat their children, they berate them. They talk them down all the time. And as a result, these children are physically and mentally abused. Now these things get lodged into the background of the subconscious mind. And they're very difficult to root out. Many of us have had to live with some of these kinds of emotional scars that have happened over time. And so we see that these bullies are trying to get happiness by becoming dominant themselves. Now we can sometimes think of bullies as being strong, because they seem to get the better of the people who are around them. But actually they are weak, because their lives are run by fear. Someone who is truly composed within themselves doesn't need to dominate the people who are around them. It's just simply not necessary. And so these individuals are acting out of fear. And that fear continues to goad them into becoming bigger and bigger bullies. Finally, the whole house of cards has to collapse. Perhaps it comes at the moment, not until the moment of death. But many times, people's lives spin more and more out of control because the fear is constantly there that somebody else will dominate the bully. And so the bully has to always be ramping up the amount of anger, the amount of abuse that they hand out to others, and they create a hellish existence for the people who are around them. This is a terrible, terrible way to live. But eventually, the karmic pattern catches up with the bully. Eventually, they come to face with themselves, with their own fears. And many times, their fears become realized. They lose their power. Perhaps they are put into jail. Perhaps they suffer even greater consequences than that. And they live a life in which they are always suspecting of everyone else around them. I thought that a wonderful saying one time came when I heard that the problem with a chronic liar isn't that they will run out of people who will believe in them. A very good liar will always find somebody who will believe what they're saying. The biggest price that a chronic liar pays is that they can never trust anyone else in their life. They will always assume that other people are also trying to lie to them, and they just try to do it better. And so they live in a world of constant suspicion. And you see, this is a real karmic price, because in that chronic suspicion, there is no real connectedness with the people around you. There is no real peace or happiness that can be had in such conditions. And our souls are always on the lookout for real happiness. And their real happiness comes from those spiritual qualities that include peace, that include joy that comes from deep within us. Now, the further a person goes out from God, the less they experience these kinds of qualities. And yet, that part of the soul never dies. It never dies. And so the misery that is created, the feeling of emptiness, the feeling of self-loathing, grows within that individual. And there's only so much that an individual soul can take. And eventually, they have to turn themselves around. They have to admit that how they've been living is wrong. And they have to turn themselves over into new values. They have to start stretching themselves out and searching for the sattvic. But you see, when they do so, They have to face all of those things that they themselves have created all down through the line. They have to face the pain that they created for other individuals. Can you imagine being an Adolf Hitler or a Joseph Stalin and having to face the pain that you created for so many millions of people? It would be quite a thing to take on. And yet these souls, because they have extraordinary magnetism, when they turn their minds towards God and toward the light, they will lead a life in such a way that it will lead millions and millions back to the light. They will be extraordinary individuals. They will be extraordinary saints when that day comes. But there's no guarantee that an individual within a particular lifetime will come to that state of realization or turn their lives around at all. But this explains how people are searching for happiness, desperately so. Some are desperately seeking for happiness through drugs. That's perhaps a more obvious one. They want happiness. They want relief from the pain that they are suffering in. And yet, as they enter into the world of drugs, they get an initial kind of hit. They get an initial happiness. They get an initial high. But with each one of those highs, because it's not an earned experience, it has diminishing qualities to it. And so there's more and more use of the drug in order to try to get the same kind of happiness. Meanwhile, their outer lives, their relationships and so forth, are oftentimes becoming destroyed. And inside, they feel more and more empty, and more dependent upon the drug that they look for the real happiness, for ananda, for bliss. They're looking for the amrita of life. But they're looking in all the wrong ways, and these are dead ends. And they will have to suffer a great price in order to recover themselves and to get their feet solidly back on the path. Not too long ago, an individual who's come to some meditation meetings wrote to me and admitted something that I'd suspected anyway, that they had been drinking a lot and that they needed help. It was ruining their lives and it's really ruining relationships in their lives. And so I suggested that they start attending AA. I think AA was a divinely inspired program. It's a wonderful program that turns people's minds away from the little human ego and starts to orientate it toward God. Now, they don't use the word God all the time. Higher power. But a rose by any other name is still a rose. We can call it the universe. We can call it a higher power. We can call it whatever we want to. But nevertheless, this is the same intelligence. It's the same supreme power that we are all worshiping. And people begin to clean their lives up, and it's a difficult battleground. There's not a day off for somebody who has been a serious addict. Every day is a day of struggle. Every day is learning to make choices of turning their life over to God rather than keeping it centered on their addiction. And so they make great spiritual progress when they really work the program. And it can do a great deal in terms of healing and cleansing their lives. So this is a wonderful thing. So he's written back and he said that he thanked me for the advice and that he felt much better and that he was finally on the right track with things. I have written and I have said that I think one of the greatest things that Mother did for me was to get me away from drugs and alcohol. I know myself, and I know that when I've gone through difficult times, down times, sad times, looking perhaps for some relief, some happiness, so the mind would tell me, that perhaps I would have turned towards alcohol use or other kinds of drugs in order to relieve the situation. And I know very definitely my life would not be the same. It would not be the same at all. And my realization of God, to whatever degree that I have it, would also not be the same. It would be a dependency. It would be a way of turning my mind away from God, not toward God. there have been some writers, there have been those who have advocated the use of drugs actually for realizing God or realizing higher states of consciousness, which is the same thing. And this is a definite dead-end alley. It does harm to the body. It weakens the mind. True enough, there are some examples where people will have extraordinary circumstances while under the influence of drugs. It will open some doors. But after a night of suffering myself from a self-induced condition from the use of drugs, God gave me a great revelation. I was sitting on a log watching the sun come up, and suddenly this tremendous thought came into my mind. There's a thought insertion. And as the thought insertion came in, it wasn't with words, but it was with realization. And it inasmuch said that drugs are like a key that can open certain doors within the mind. But the yogis that you have been reading about had discovered other means for opening those same doors and much, much greater doors than those. And they can do it in complete safety. Now, after the rough night that I had, the complete safety, because I thought I was going to die. So the complete safety sounded like a good thing to me. And so that started me. I immediately quit the use of those drugs with any idea that they're going to produce any state of realization. Because they don't, not in the long run. They will produce a state of dependency. They produce many false kinds of states of mind. And in many cases, they release subconscious and also psychic kinds of entities and thoughts and ideas that can destroy the mind. I remember meeting a fellow when I was hitchhiking one time. And he told me that he had taken some LSD. And that the last thing that he remembered was a great sun beaming down on him and coming into his head and exploding. And the next thing he was aware of was 3 months later, and he's in a mental institution. And when I met him, he was still not all right in the brain. He had many difficulties as a result. You see, it creates a tear in the psychic body. And it allows information both from the subconscious mind and from the psychic world to stream into the mind. Now, most of us have barriers against such information because it would be disturbing and it would overwhelm us. It's not until we rise up into God consciousness that we really have the capacity to handle this stream of information in balance. And so when he had this kind of condition, he opened up a psychic tear. And as a result of that, there was much that was streaming into his mind that he didn't really have the capacity to be able to handle. So these are very, very important and serious matters. And they are not things to be undertaken lightly. As one student once said, she was married at the time, and she told her husband that she was thinking about taking some hallucinogenic drugs. And he said, "Are you kidding me? That's your brain." And that woke her up. And she said, "You're right, that's my brain. If I destroy that, what have I got left?" So we have to be careful of these things. And we shouldn't enter into them in the first place. So as one of the greatest things that Mother did for me was to get me completely out of that world so that I could turn my dependence, if you want to call it that, toward God and not towards these substances that will alleviate pain for a little while but create long-term pain after a while, not creating any happiness at all. So the yogi strives after sattvic kind of happiness. Those are the positive virtues in life. Those are the things that make us feel healthy, make us feel a sense of well-being, makes us feel that we're at one with God. But then Master refers to that pure sattvic joy is unending, ever-new, culminating at last in the eternal ananda, bliss of spirit, beyond any of the gunas, even sattva. Now, how does this work? For such a soul as Mother, when they have realized their complete and full oneness with God, they are no longer conditioned by the three gunas. Their oneness with God will be with them in whatever state they are taken to. And sometimes God will take such a one as Mother into the what we might call the negative guna, or escape my mind right now.
Tamasic,
thank you. The tamasic state. And so if the tamasic state is dominant, usually for people, they're in a depressed state. They're in a down state. And they don't perceive God there. It's the one that's considered most antithetical toward God. And then there is the rajasic, which is the activated state. And for people who are overly mindful of the rajasic state, they are restless. They can't sit down. They can't do anything other than be in a constant state of restlessness. And so, of course, there's no peace there. There's no real joy there. There's just the dominance of being in high activity. And so when you are established in God consciousness, God for his own purposes may take you into a tamasic or a rajasic state. Perhaps you are helping the disciples to work out their own karma, or the world at large to work out its karma. Perhaps he's doing it for some specific purpose, so that those who are around that one can see that one in those various states, but yet they are always in the state of oneness with God. There were times when, with Papa, some individual or some people would be coming. And Papa would be up and pacing back and forth, waiting for them, anxious for them to come, particularly if they were late in coming. And so, pacing back and forth, he would appear to be, to all the senses, to be in a rajasic state. And yet, in his state of consciousness, he was always in oneness with God. And he was acting as God was moving through him. And he felt God as movement through his body. And if it came as a rajasic state, then that was all right with him. There's another time when Papa became very angry. There was a certain sadhu, and he was not acting properly toward some of the ladies in the ashram. And so Papa finally determined he'd heard enough one day, and he went to the sadhu's room. And he was determined to make this sadhu leave the ashram. Well, the ashram, the sadhu had the door locked. And he wouldn't open the door when Papa was knocking on it, asking him to come out. And finally the man came out, and he had shaved his head completely. And Papa said, "You must leave." And the man refused. And so Papa began to shove the man and started kicking him and said, "You have to leave now." Now, this is how God was moving through Papa at the time. And there were those who were standing around who assumed that Papa was not who he said he was, or that somehow he had gotten caught up in the delusion of the moment. His anger had gotten the better of him. And yet Papa knew that this was God who was acting through him in this way, and that he had to take strong action in order to protect the ashram and the sanctity of it. And so there are those who are around who actually loved Papa at that time. They lost faith in him. And yet this was God who was acting through him. Mother told the story of one day standing behind Papa, and she saw and heard Papa speaking to some of the workers. And he spoke in a very angry voice. And suddenly he turned around and he saw Mother standing beside him and said, "Mother, did you think that Ram Dass was angry?" And Mother said, "I don't know, Papa, were you?" He said, "No, it's just the way you need to speak to these chaps to get them to do anything." And so this is the way that God sometimes operates, because it's what's needed in the moment. There were times when Mother talked about staying in the room underneath Master's, and late into the night she could hear him at times speaking in a loud voice, giving what for to certain disciples. Peggy Dietz described one time of seeing Master speak very harshly to one of the nuns. And then suddenly Master stopped, he turned around, he looked at Peggy, and he winked, and he gave her a smile. And then he turned around and he continued his berating talk. It's because of what she needs in that particular moment, you see. Some souls need to get waken up. Now, you can't use this as a license for her behavior, for being out of control yourself. When you are experiencing your oneness with God, and you feel God flowing through you, you may experience Him at times, and they will be selective, to be times of anger. There may be even times of feeling down, because you feel the weight of ignorance weighing down on you in a tamasic kind of a mood. And yet, through it all, you don't feel identified with whatever it is that's surrounding you and coming on you at the time. You feel your inward oneness with God through it all. This is the difference between a realized state, being established in this eternal happiness, and being subject to all the various moods and the different situations that will happen in your life. Now, our goal in this life is to become one with God, is to know that we have our oneness with God no matter what else may be going on in our life. To have that as our constant and abiding state of mind. Now, you have to be honest with yourself. You have to hold yourself to the highest standards. I once asked Swami Satchitananda, "Swamiji, are you in a state of perfect realization? Are you in Sahaja Samadhi?" And he said, "No." He said, "Papa described that as it being an effortless state, that you have attained to that state of consciousness and no further effort is required." He said, "I have not yet attained to that highest state." You see what stunning honesty Swamiji has. And there's no pretense with him. There's no illusion that he's something that he is not. And so this is something for us to emulate. It's to be deadly honest with ourselves. If not with ourselves, then who can we be honest with? And to be honest with God. We do not begin the journey at the end. We don't begin in a state of perfect realization. We begin with exactly where you are right now, today. This is your baseline. This is where you're starting from. And every day is an effort to improve your life. How do you improve? You keep your mind on God. You focus upon Him in deepened meditation. You learn to serve Him in all the people who are in your life. Now, sometimes this is most difficult to the people who are closest to us. The people whom we love the most. Sometimes we take them for granted. Sometimes we are overly familiar. And Master oftentimes warned about becoming overly familiar with those who are in our lives close to us. Remember, every individual has God at their inner core. And they should be treated with respect. They should be treated and seen as that light. But you may say, "But their behavior doesn't justify it. See what they have done. See what they said to me. See how they hurt my feelings. See how they betrayed me." And I say, all the more important for you to see God within that one. They need it more. Papa felt that was the greatest thing he could do for any individual, was to see God with them. It helped to awaken God within him. So to serve God within everyone that we meet, and strangers as well, learn to see God within the stranger. Learn to see God within those who perhaps don't dress as nicely, don't behave quite correctly. See God in them. For goodness sake, see God in them. For they need it so much. Who else is going to do it if you do not do it? So much of the judgments that we have in this life are not needed. They're not required. Just look at the mind. Observe your own mind. What a constant commentary there is going on there oh, this person is this way and this person is that way. Finding fault, finding shortcomings with everyone that we meet. And perhaps most of all with our own selves. What a useless bunch of dialogue that is. Do not give in to such things. Yes, you have your opinions. Yes, you have your own values. But don't give in to it as a constant dialogue. Rather, cultivate and see God within this world. See God within the leaders of this country. Who needs it more than they? Than to see God awakened in them. Yes, we may have disagreements with them. Yes, we may not approve of everything that they do. But for goodness sake, see God within them. You see what a cultivation of attitude that is. What a cultivation of mind that is. And what happens when you do? You find God within yourself. Because most of our commentary about others is really about ourselves. And so the more you find God within others, the more you will find God within yourself. And awaken that God-like nature within you. So this search for happiness is something that is universal. It is something that is ongoing for all people, for all creation everywhere. And it is something that we are studying the science of right here and now. Determine today, you know, all emotions are preceded by a thought. Now that's quite a thing to say. It's based on what Mother taught. But I know that it is true. Emotions can come on us very quickly, but there is always a thought that precedes it. Learn to control your mind, and you will control your emotions. You will change them. Change your attitude, if you want to change your altitude, as the saying goes. Because attitude determines altitude. If somebody were to call you today in a survey and ask, are you extremely or very happy? How would you answer, honestly? Could you honestly say that you are very, very happy? And yet, as devotees, as aspirants, you may not have achieved everything that you want, but you are in the midst of it. If you are on track with what you know to be living your life as it truly should be lived, you should have equal claim to happiness and peace as anyone else in this world. You may be a project incomplete. Nevertheless, if you're on track with your own spiritual growth and doing what you know you should be doing, you have a claim to total and complete happiness right here, right now. And so I would hope that everyone here can answer in the affirmative, are you happy in your life? How could we not be? We're on our path. We've been given our path. We have a path to follow that's clear. And we're following it. How could we not be happy in such circumstances? Why not? Why not? So let us determine through our own thoughts, through our own attitude, through our own attunement to God, to be happy every day, find cause for joy within the soul, and you will find that happiness. It is not far from you, for it is your natural state. Please join me in prayer. O Heavenly Father,
O Heavenly Father,
Divine Mother,
Divine Mother,
I feel the wonder and the beauty,
I feel the wonder and the beauty
of Thy glorious presence,
of Thy glorious presence
in every part of my being,
in every part of my being.
My heart is bursting with my love for Thee.
My heart is bursting with my love for Thee.
I kneel in adoration at Thy feet.
I kneel in adoration at Thy feet
and surrender myself to Thee.
And surrender myself to Thee.
I feel the power of Thy perfection.
I feel the power of Thy perfection
surging in every cell of my body.
Surging in every cell of my body.
My mind and my intelligence.
My mind and my intelligence
are radiant with Thy healing light.
Are radiant with Thy healing light.
My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss.
My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss
of my communion with Thee.
Of my communion with Thee.
I and my Father are one.
I and my Father are one.
Blessed Spirit, I am He.
Blessed Spirit, I am He.
Ooh.